Hello, everyone. Welcome. I'm Tamar Jacoby. I'm a senior fellow of the Manhattan Institute. And for myself and on behalf of the Institute, I'm truly honored to introduce Ward Connerly. I don't think I have to tell anyone in this room who Ward Connerly is. He's the principal leader of the political movement to end affirmative action. It's an achievement that speaks for itself, and I think Ward is going to talk a little bit about his biography. But if you can indulge me for a minute or two before he does that, I think there are a number of things to note about his achievement, things that we tend to overlook or sometimes take for granted. The first thing is the sheer magnitude of Ward's accomplishment, something I think we do overlook because we're so close to it. Historic is an overused word, but what Ward has accomplished in the last few years in California and elsewhere is truly historic. Just imagine, if you will, and it's not the only measure, but just imagine the history books 100 or 200 years from now. Even the most cursory survey of American history in the 20th century is going to talk about the civil rights movement. The text will note the momentous changes that happened in the wake of that movement, the transformation of American life, most of it for the better. But they will also note how, in the wake of that movement, Americans adopted a huge, convoluted system of color-coded double standards, a system that threatened to reinforce the very pernicious racial categories we were trying to get rid of, and in fact undermined the principle of equal opportunity that's the foundation of the American system. This was no small thing, no mere byproduct or side effect. For a while, unrecognized by much of the nation, it looked as if the very purpose of the civil rights movement and much else about American life was going to be subverted by these color-coded double standards. And then, at the end of the 20th century, a small group of courageous people mobilized to roll that system back. And within a very few years, they were having serious, real success. It's something I think we overlook because we're so close to it, but it's truly a historic achievement. And without Ward, I'm not so sure it would be happening. Not yet, and not at the pace that we're seeing. So that's the first thing, the magnitude of the accomplishment. The second thing that's easy to forget about Ward, or maybe take for granted because he wears it so lightly, is the courage with which he's done what he does. When Ward and his allies started out in California in the early 90s, most people told him it couldn't be done. Not only was the left against him and the entire educational establishment and many, if not most, ordinary well-intentioned newspaper readers, but the Republican Party and business leadership also resisted his efforts, if not not vigorously opposed them in some cases. Ward was vilified from coast to coast. One of the ugliest attacks happened here in New York. A 5,000-word front-page article in the New York Times, full of a vicious and undocumented innuendo about Ward's personal life and his family and his character. And the truth is, bad as that story was, it's nothing compared to the kinds of things that lots of people say in private every day about Ward. Black people and white people who've never met him but who hate him with a passion. And, you know, it's never easy to put yourself in someone else's place, but I'm not sure I or anyone who hasn't been in those shoes can really understand what it must be like to be vilified the way Ward is all the time. I'm not sure that any of us can understand what it's like to be called a traitor to one's people. I'm not sure I can imagine it, and I'm not sure I could go on in the face of it. But Ward persists, fighting for what he believes in. And easy as it is, I think, for us to, or much as we do often take it for granted, we are all the beneficiaries of that courage. Third, and I'll end with this, I'd like to say just a word about the quality of Ward's character, because that too is extraordinary and in a way easy to take for granted. Most people think of idealism and practicality as polar opposites, things that are hard to bring together or hard to find together in one individual. But anyone who knows Ward or who has ever worked with him knows that he defies that expectation too. One of the most important things about him, one of the things that makes him the great man he is that he really believes it makes no difference what color a person's skin is. Now, that doesn't sound like such a big thing. I think most of us in this room would say that we agree with that, we agree in theory with that statement, but Ward really believes it. Ward lives his life that way, and believe me, it's actually a very rare thing on either side of the color line. For Ward, color really makes no difference, no more than the color of your hair or the color of the tie you're wearing. So that's the man of principle, and Ward is an inspiring man of principle. But make no mistake, and beware if you do, Ward is also a brilliant political strategist. I think he's going to talk more about the details, and I don't want to steal his thunder, but I was just thinking to myself the other day, and I think it kind of sums it up. Thank God this guy is on our side, and if you doubt me, just try going up against him on something. And with that, and without further ado, allow me to give you Ward Connerly.
Thank you, Tamar, very much. It's a pleasure to be with all of you and to see people who have been so supportive over the years, especially Jenny Gilder and Paul Singer and Midge and Norm and all of the others that I recognize, but especially you two. I am enormously grateful for all that you have done to provide the fuel, and to Roy Ennis, who, when no one else would come into California and stand beside me on Proposition 209, Roy was there. My friend, thank you very much. And to Mike, thank you very much as well. As I listen to Tamar, I'm reminded of an actual experience I had about 2 weeks ago. I was in the green room getting ready for a program, and she was putting powder on and all that stuff, and she said, "Oh, we have an author coming in today." And I said, "Really, who?" And she said, "Some guy with a book, Creating Equal." And it didn't dawn on me at that stage that my role had changed somewhat. I'm just an ordinary businessman who is trying to live out the true meaning of his creed, and I find my station in life changing almost constantly. And I just want to kind of ramble with you a little bit. I've reach the point where when you're giving 3 and 4 appearances a day, you don't have time to prepare speeches. You just go out and clear your soul and ramble. And I want to do a little bit of that tonight. For the last 5 years or so, I and many of you in this room, those that I've mentioned as well as Steve and Abby, have been out there in the vineyards campaigning religiously against the use of race, the granting of government preferences in the area of employment and education and college admissions on the basis of race and sex and color and ethnicity and national origin. And we've had a fair measure of success. In the state of California, we have convinced the Board of Regents, the University of California, arguably one of the most prestigious public universities in the world, that it was wrong constitutionally, morally to do that. We then went on to the broader electorate and convinced the people of California, one of the most racially and ethnically diverse places on the planet, that they should follow the suit of the regents of the University of California and embed that principle of equality into the Constitution of the state of California. We then took our fight to the state of Washington, and we went up against Microsoft and Boeing and the Seattle Times and all of the others, and we prevailed by a margin of 58.5 to 41.5, a truly remarkable victory in the state of Washington. We went into Texas and Houston, and had it not been for some shenanigans on the part of the city council there and Mayor Lanier, we would have won there in the city of Houston. Despite the fact that we did not get any support from the Republican establishment in the city of Houston. We then had to decide where do we go next to make sure that we make a strong statement in the nation that preferences, and that's really what it is, have no place in American life. So we went into the state of Florida, despite the fact that many of our strongest allies said, don't go there, give our Republican friends a pass. Florida is under Republican control in the legislature and the state house, and I can't tell you the number of my allies who said, don't go, just stay out of Florida, give Jeb a pass, and go someplace else. I ignored that counsel for a number of reasons, and I want to just kind of share with you the reasons why, and hope that you can understand, and hope that at the end of the day, and in the fullness of time, you will appreciate why we did it, and you will get some better sense of where we go after Florida. Florida is an urban dynamic, a profoundly urban state whose racial and ethnic composition is changing radically. It's a southern state with a very large black presence, with a very large Hispanic presence, a state controlled by Republicans, people who are just as cowardly about this issue as Democrats are exploitive about this issue. One is the cowardice of one is matched only by the exploitation and the demagoguery of the other. And so I felt that if we went into Florida and prevailed there, and in my gut I knew that the people of Florida agreed with us on this principle, but if we went to Florida and prevailed, I believe we could then declare victory throughout the nation. That was the reason for going to Florida. When I first met with Governor Jeb Bush back in January of the year 1999, and I said to him, Governor, there are preferences in your state. I'd like your support, if only to remain silent, I'd like your support to allow us to get this initiative on the ballot. Jeb Bush walked over to the wall and pointed to a picture of young black kids on the wall, and he said, I want to help them. I want to help them with school vouchers. And if I join in your effort, I will imperil the coalition that I want to build to allow us to do that. And I said, you don't think I want to help them? Do you think that giving them preference, do you think that ignoring what is going on right now, do you think really that that is helping them? And the governor kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, you want a fight, you want to go to war, I'm a lover, end quotes. Next day, that was portrayed as if I was some rabid, saliva-dripping right-winger who wanted to take away all opportunity for black and Hispanic kids in the state of Florida. And that was the paradigm that existed for several months. Polls were taken, however, which showed that, quote, Hispanics favored our position by about 55% to 45%. The overall population was with us 65 to 35. And that never changed. That never changed, despite the Republican Party denying me access to the Republican convention, beating up on me in the press for 7 or 8 months, constant. But nonetheless, the public, with their laser beam sense of what's right, supported us unwaveringly for all that time. In early November, the Miami Herald and the St. Pete Times came out with a poll that they commissioned. And that poll showed that whether you use the term preference or whether you use the term affirmative action, the people of Florida wanted to roll it all back, not piece by piece, all of it, by a margin of about 65% to 35%. At that stage, Jeb made an announcement that he was going to issue an executive order to end preferences at the university and to admit the top 20% of every high school graduate. He left untouched local government preferences. He left untouched preferences in those state agencies that are not under his immediate control. So essentially, it's a fig leaf what he has proposed in the state of Florida. It's significant, however, in the sense that he has finally admitted that indeed there are preferences in the state of Florida, and in his words, they are legally suspect and morally wrong. That is a victory, and we never would have accomplished that had we not forced Jeb to look at this issue on its merits and to take a position. Most importantly, the Republican Party there now realizes that this can be a plus politically for them and not a negative. I mean, do the arithmetic, 65% to 35%. Now, we have run into some obstacles in the state of Florida, the most significant of which is the Supreme Court. Almost every state has a requirement that any initiative that goes on the ballot consist of one subject. They call that the single subject rule. Most states consider the language "the state shall not discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to any individual or group on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in the operation of public employment, public education, or public contracting" to be one subject. It's discrimination. It's the rights of citizens. However, the Florida Supreme Court may very well decide that that initiative constitutes multiple subjects. Race, they will probably say, is one subject. Color is another subject. Ethnicity is another subject. National origin is another subject. Sex is another subject. The state is many subjects: state government, local government, the university, special districts. Education is multiple subjects: higher education, K through 12, preschool. All of those could be multiple subjects. In the hands of an activist liberal court, the chances are very, very great that we will not make it to the ballot this November. But what will happen is the court will tell us what defect they find in our initiative, and then we will instantly go back to the drawing boards and craft the initiatives so that we can systematically peel back the onion and accomplish our objectives over the next 2 years or so. They will dodge a bullet, they will craft speed bumps for us, but it will not constitute a stop sign, because we will know then exactly what we have to do to accomplish our objectives. Our attorneys say that we could need as many as 45 initiatives to do what Proposition 209 did. I think that with three initiatives, one dealing with local government, one dealing with contracting at the state level, and one dealing with higher education, we get 85% of what we hope to accomplish. And by that time, I hope that I have gone off into the sunset and done other things, but certainly I don't intend to spend 45 years in the state of Florida. The other problem that is quite significant that we have challenged, and we have done it for strategic reasons, I will confess to you, is that we have forced the hand of what I call the black establishment. I knew going into Florida that it was not going to be the kind of scenario that we had in California and that we had in Washington State. I knew that. The population there, the black population, still has a somewhat southern mentality, a rural mentality. They still have this close connection with Jim Crow and with slavery in their minds. They still want to preserve race for every purpose you can think of. The time has come to confront that. The time has come for our nation to confront it. And so I wanted to present that issue out there and force people to start dealing with it. Force us to start dealing with it. Jeb has been the one who has had to take the brunt of it. But he asked for that. He asked for that. He's gotten himself into that spot. When Jeb issued his executive order eliminating preferences at the university, he decided that he would admit the top 20%, guarantee admission to the university of the top 20% of all high school graduates. My friends, that will provide access to the university far greater than the system that is now in existence, far greater. One would think that the NAACP and all of the others would applaud with glee. Instead, they opposed him. Predictably, they opposed him. Not because the plan would result in fewer black kids going to the University of Florida, but because this was an opening to stick it to Jeb Bush, to get at the Republicans. That revealed, in my view, what I already knew. Black people, unfortunately, in the South and elsewhere, are a franchise of the Democratic Party. We know that, but this is glaring evidence of that fact. They would rather embarrass Jeb Bush than to support a plan that clearly makes it available for more black kids to go to the university. Now, on its educational merits, I don't like the 20% plan. I think it's an erosion of the quality of the institution. But that's a different subject. Just on the question of preferences, what Jeb has done, from their perspective, deserves to be supported. But they won't support him. 11,000 people go to Tallahassee, and they have an old-fashioned 1960s rally. Wasn't a lot of people, 11,000. Hell, we put those in a telephone booth in California when they're upset. But 11,000 people go to Florida, the NAACP, the Rainbow Coalition, the Urban League, the National Organization for Women, and they call Jeb Bush Jeb Crow, liken him to George Wallace. Now, that says to me that compassionate conservatism, if it remains silent about something that you believe in, is doomed to failure. If it means that you have to keep quiet about something that you believe in, which is what I was being counseled to allow Jeb to do, if that's what it means, if you think you can go from 14% black vote in Florida to 18% by remaining silent on the question of whether preferences should be allowed, it ain't going to work, folks. It won't work. So if all you're going to go do is go from 14 to 18, and you're probably not going to do that, why not stick to your principal belief and argue that point and campaign on that point? If we win in Florida, and I predict that we will have moved the ball from the 20-yard line, maybe the 40-yard line of our side of the field, to the 20-yard line of their side. We won't have to do this state by state any longer. I think we will have demonstrated to the American people that the regime of race preferences is over. We can declare victory. But at that point, it's time now for us to move to the next level, the final level. Ronald Reagan said in August of 1992, his last appearance before the American people, "Whether we come from poverty or wealth, whether we are Afro-American or Irish-American, Christian or Jewish, from big cities or small towns, in the eyes of God, we're all equal." But in America, he said, that's not enough. We have to be equal in the eyes of each other. That says to me that despite what the founder said about all men being created equal, the task of creating equal is one that we have to do. We have to undertake that task. Government can't do it for us. We have to create that equal every day of our lives, in every transaction between Norm and me, and between Midge and Jenny and me. We have to create that state of equal. It's a never-ending process. So removing preferences is only part of the story. The rest of the story is that we have to confront the system of race in America. And believe me, it's there. We see it in South Carolina. As we talk about the Confederate flag and Bob Jones' stupid prohibition about interracial dating that they have rescinded to some extent, we see it in California at Pelican Bay with Chicano prisoners fighting white prisoners and black prisoners. We see it at the University of California with Russian students sometimes being discriminated against in favor of Mexican students. We see it as we talk about preferences in the state of Florida. We see it as Vice President Gore goes to Apollo and outrageously panders to people on the basis of race. We see it as Jesse Jackson talks about the digital divide and the NAACP goes to Hollywood and browbeats Hollywood. We see it with the Wall Street Project, Paul. We see it all over the place. Race is the centerpiece of American life right now. And you know, the irony is that in 1963, John F. Kennedy said race has no place in American life or law. Jesse Jackson says now that we have to be color-caring. And that if we don't take race into account, we're racist. Figure that one out. So I think that we have to make the decision whether race has no place in American life or law, or whether, as Justice Harlan said in the Bakke decision, race matters, and you have to use race to get beyond race. And we have been using race to get beyond race for 30 years almost. And we're not getting beyond it. As Tamar says in her great book, Someone Else's House, we're not getting beyond race. We're not integrating anymore. Race is seeping out of every pore of government, of our lives. At the very time that people are, as Steve and Abby says, are married, crossing racial lines to marry, at the very time that phenomenon is happening, others are embedding it more and more into public policy. It's time for us now to get beyond it, to examine the usage of terms like African American, to examine what it means when you say someone is a minority. We're all a minority of one. Everybody in this room is different to some extent. You're all minorities. Why use skin color? We have to examine that. We've got to examine this census business. If people decide to check multiple boxes, why should the census automatically classify them as something that they didn't necessarily check? We have to start getting beyond this issue of race. And we have to craft the movement that gets us beyond it. If we don't, black people are going to be locked in this position of being captives to one party for the rest of our lives. We will never get to the point where black people will be self-reliant and consider themselves capable of being full citizens in American life. All you have to do is go to one college campus and look at some of these very talented kids who are black, who believe that their futures are clearly imperiled by bad guys like me who are taking away affirmative action. We don't want large numbers of kids. We don't want any kids feeling that they can't do it on their own. Yet that's the reality. That's the reality. And this election is an important one. And I want my nominee, as a Republican, I want him to embrace this principle of equality. I want him to fight for it. I want him to show the difference between the world that we will have with race not mattering and the world we're going to have with Al Gore's race matters philosophy. And here's what I'm going to do for you people. And black people will be enslaved mentally and emotionally for the rest of their lives. And I don't want that. And I don't think you want it. And those of us who are conservatives, the task falls to us to try to lead that movement to get us beyond race. Thank you very much.
Floor is open for questions. Please identify yourselves. Let's start with that.
Hi, I'm Bill Brownwell. I'm a sponsor of the Mountain Institute. I think one of the problems in this whole discourse is the imprecise use of the term affirmative action. On the one hand, it's clearly used to describe system preferences, but I think it also has a meaning that, for example, a given university might want to expand their horizons by going out into various minority communities where they haven't been before. You call that affirmative action, I say that's great. And lastly, I wanted to ask you if you agree with Justice Powell's position in the Bakke decision that it is legitimate to use race as a fact. Of course, as we all know, that decision has been perverted, but basically what he said was that it's okay to use race as a factor when you're making a final decision, all other things being more or less equal.
No, I do not agree with that decision. And that is precisely why you need measures like Proposition 209. Because, you know, it's like that old saying, you're just a little bit pregnant. You either use race or you don't. And the narrow opening provided by Justice Powell, people started driving a Mack truck through it. and race, when you have an 8,000-point system at the University of California, you have 33,000 students applying for 3,500 seats at Berkeley. 14,000 of those students have 4.0s or higher. Over half of those 14,000 happen to be Asian. Only 200 are black students. That reveals the wide gap in academic performance. And if you want to get 300 black students there, roughly, no quota, mind you, no quota, but we just want a critical mass of 300 students, you're going to have to use race not as an itty bitty teeny factor. It's going to become the factor, and that only puts it's not a band-aid, it puts a Lone Ranger mask over the real problem, and you never get to solving the problem. Now, I think it's a terrible decision, and it's really why we need these initiatives to say, in fact, that race can't be used as one of any factors, no matter what the Supreme Court said. Now, the question of whether you can use affirmative action. We didn't outlaw all affirmative action. And despite the fact that our opponents try to suggest that we were eliminating affirmative action, we argued over and over again that we were not eliminating affirmative action. We didn't choose the terms preferential treatment to deceive people. We chose the term because we wanted to eliminate preferences. There's nothing wrong with going out and advertising broadly to make sure that people know about opportunities. There's nothing wrong with going to underperforming schools without regard to race and trying to prepare those students. Not only is there nothing wrong with it, we ought to be doing that. And so we did not end affirmative action. The University of California this fiscal year will be spending $250 million on outreach programs. Much of that is money that is simply redirected from programs that weren't doing diddly squat and some new money involved to make sure that we are working with the 150 lowest performing schools in California, starting at the first grade. Most of our outreach programs were dealing with these kids at the ninth grade, and we were showing a success rate of 85 to 90% of those participating in our outreach programs going on to college. So, you know, that doesn't prove anything if you're starting at the ninth grade. So we said, we're not worried about the successes. Don't worry about the failures. Start working with these kids at an earlier age. Try to make sure that they're capable to compete, to be competitively admissible. And don't worry about the failure rate. So we have preserved affirmative action. We've shown the sheer hypocrisy of the term as some use it. And it's working. It's working in California.
Go ahead.
Yeah, why don't I just do that then? Yeah.
I'm James Trotter from Wall Street Journal. What do you think about the so-called class-based affirmative action? That is, preferences based on economic hardship or social pathology rather than race?
Well, the whole reason I think that the taxpayers are subsidizing students who go to the university to the tune of California to the tune of $12,000 a year is to try to make sure that as large of a number of people as possible get a good quality higher education. If the choice is in fact that we're going to make that opportunity available to a low-income person who has done all the things that are required, who has worked harder, as opposed to someone who has had no disadvantages. I opt for giving it to the person who is low income. The libertarian side of me says, well, that's disadvantaging someone who is not low income. But you have to make the trade-off. If someone doesn't really need the government assistance, and if there's no economic reason involved, why is the government involved in education? Let it all be done by the private sector. So the compelling reason for me to have the government involved in higher education or any education is to make sure that those who can't afford it get that opportunity. So if all things are essentially equal, I do opt in favor of class-based or income-based, rather, affirmative action. Mike.
Michael Myers, I want to follow up on that question. Before there was affirmative action,
and you think the Supreme Court of Florida is going to be a genius. Wait until you get people to control affirmative action programs. They could be very ingenious in terms of making euphemisms and constructive futures and substituting something else for what they have now, but coming out of the Senate. For example, the equivalent of affirmative action in New York State, public colleges, they've had educational opportunity fund programs for economically disadvantaged class-based affirmative action programs. It just so happens that every black that was admitted to the public college, public colleges came through the disadvantaged category. So all blacks who went to college were disadvantaged. And the reasons for the study of that is that, why are you doing this? So people who control affirmative action programs, who are the architects of this, can use substitutes. They can use, really use other things for rent to achieve their purpose. So class doesn't do it, at least in terms of my opinion. Now, if we know the demographics are changing, so that you say everybody's minority, we have black, Asian, new immigrants, some who don't even speak English, doing very well and preparing themselves for college, on merit, why don't we just go to a system completely of merit so that those minorities who do not do well now will be given the message that you have to do well in order to get to college, regardless of class, regardless of income, regardless of all the excuses and alibis we've been using to use race as a proxy for getting them into college. Why just we can't go to a system of merit?
All right. We are trying to go to one of individual merit. The problem, however, is how do you define merit? If we said that we're simply going to define it on the basis of how well you score on the SAT and how on your grade point average, at the University of California, we would have roughly all students and only students over 4.0, probably 4.2, and 1,500 on the SAT. That's the problem. The demand is so great, the seats are so few, that if we simply define merit by the absolute numbers, Mike, we're going to get a student body that I don't think most of us really would want to do. I don't think we'd want to define merit in that terms. I certainly wouldn't. So that means we're going to have to look at people as individuals. We're going to have somewhat different standards of merit. We're not going to try to find surrogates for race. But I don't think that we can say that merit is simply going to be the highest SATs and grade point averages, combine the two, we'll start out at 33,000 or at 14,000, whatever it is, and work down, and when we get to 11,500, that's it. That's it. Nobody else gets in. I don't think we want to do that. So I think that we have to look at what are the other factors that define merit. If there's someone who gets a 4.0 and has a 1,400 SAT and they work 30 hours a week and they're involved in an internship for some agency and they're involved in student government and they're working in a lot of other things, isn't that some measurement of their merit? I think it is. So it almost ends up being an individual assessment. And really, when you start thinking about the fact that this is the most important decision we're ever going to make about that person's life, they warrant it. They warrant that. It takes about 2 hours. I sat on a norming session of the Berkeley Admissions Committee about 3 weeks ago. And believe me, there's not much difference between a student with a 1450 SAT and a 4.0 and a student with a 1400 SAT and a 4.1. So you almost have to look at these students individually to make the right decision. Race should never be a factor, and I would not countenance any kind of surrogates or proxies for race. But I also don't want to just go by the rote numbers and say, all right, you got the highest SAT, you merit getting in, everybody else is out. Yes.
Before I ask the question, I might note that Aristotle says that everybody believes that distributive justice is proportionate to equality based on merit, but nobody can decide what merit is. 2,500 years ago. I'm wondering if, in light of the historical slavery and segregation, which has brought down to us, certainly in my life, whether the anti-discrimination principle as a way of dealing with
replace the appropriate premises, or whether or not it continues within itself, that kind of self-destructive set of consequences. You pointed out the problems with reverse the anti-discrimination principle has undercut a lot of our intermediating organizations. The Boy Scouts are in the Supreme Court this term, the political parties are in the Supreme Court this term over whether they can select their own members. And of course, the institution of the family has been assaulted in the name of the anti-discrimination principle. That is to say, we give special treatment to the child rearing unit, and that is constantly under assault by people who do not define themselves within that unit. So my question is really, is there another principle besides the anti-discrimination principle that one can talk about the problems wrought by slavery and segregation, this country's historical legacy? And when we have a language for even talking about the problem, aside from the anti-discrimination principle, I have in mind maybe some retributive justice or reconciliation, something along the lines that John Paul just spoke about last week. We certainly haven't dealt with problems with atrocities like the Holocaust or Japanese internment under the anti-discrimination principle.
First of all, I'm always amused by the term reverse discrimination. Isn't that almost a positive? Discrimination, if we think discrimination is wrong, the reverse of discrimination would be what?
I think being a discriminating person just wants a compliment.
I think that the Civil Rights Act of 64 was the right thing. I think it's the right thing. I think that our government should, in fact, given the history of our nation, given the noble aspiration of making sure people do not have traits over which they had no control used against them in the transactions of government. I think, no matter how much I'm a libertarian, I think that was the right thing to do. And I support that. Obviously, I support it, or I wouldn't be standing here now. I think that when you open your doors to the public, I'm staying down at the Grand Hyatt, and if someone said that I couldn't go into the Grand Hyatt because it's a private establishment and they have a right to discriminate if they want to, the consequences that would flow from that would be enormous. Just imagine me driving around in a cab, jumping out, running into some place and saying, "Do you serve black people? Can a black person stay here?" Just because they're private. Just think that through. So I think that there are reasons why we want to say, no, even though you're private, if you're a public accommodation, you open your doors to the public, you say you're going to serve the public, that right is somehow going to be abridged. Your right to discriminate is going to be taken away. Now, there are certain private establishments, however, where there is no government money involved. It's a Chinese restaurant. They want it to be authentic. They don't want to hire people who look like me. I don't have a problem with it. If I do, I just don't eat there anymore. That's my choice. But I think that we still have to preserve the notion. We have to preserve the notion that in certain arenas of life, anti-discrimination must be the practice, it must be the policy, it must be the reality. In our time and for the nation we want to build, that has to be the way we go. And when we commit ourselves to that, however, in government, we have to be true to that. We have to be true to that. We can't say, we only did that to make sure you didn't discriminate against black people. We did it because we want to make sure you discriminate against no one. We have crafted this Orwellian notion that if we discriminate against someone who is black or female or I don't even know what the term is anymore, Latino, Hispanic, Chicano, I don't know, but if we discriminate against someone who is quote, a minority, that is discrimination. If we discriminate against someone, and it's almost the only group in our society that we can say that, if we discriminate against someone who is white and male, we're just building diversity. We have to be pure to the terms. We have to be pure to the terms. I'll go over here. Norm.
Norm, I'm Horace. I want to support Michael Meyer on the issue of marriage. I think what you just, the last remark you made is fully consistent with the appeal that he made for a marriage-based system. It seems to me that I agree with you. I mean, 140, yes, 141 is not a, you know, a major difference, and one needn't be so rigid as to be valid. On the other hand, having many of us in this room are old enough to have lived through systems based on merit and defined by these kinds of tests, plus personal interviews, plus recommendations from teachers. We know, and we've heard of the principles on this, that these tests, despite everything that's been said about them with their bias, the inner bias, are still the best predictors of performance in school. We know from the work of Thomas Sullivan that a lot of kids are mismatched at university where the demands are greater than they can fulfill, and who would, however, do well at other institutions, and who in fact do well at other institutions. We know, speaking of blacks alone, that high schools like Dunbar in Washington were better under segregation, scholastically, academically, than most of the white schools in Washington, which just gives us an indication of what can happen if standards are enforced in the terms in which we use the word merit. So, I don't know, I don't see what's so terrible about an outcome that is going to half the population, half the student body, from Berkeley, the Korean and Chinese, and
position. I respect what you're saying, but if we just went T and we added up their great point averages, we would still come up with all these kids that have identically the same score. Now, at that point, what are we going to do?
Well, you've got recommendations, you've got interviews, you've got personal assessment, you've got those other factors
okay.
That come into play. By the way, that happened when I was a kid, too. You know, they used to judge you, well, what kind of extracurricular activity did you engage in or not? You know, what did your teachers have to say about you? Yeah, I mean, there were all
okay.
Kinds of stuff.
Okay.
I'm afraid I hate to leave the room full of hands, but I'm afraid you want to give the last word on that or some other topic?
Right back here. That hand went up several times.
Yeah, I'm a software venture capitalist, and right now there are not a tremendous number of blacks in my business. But one thing I've noticed is that the ones that are there, and there's some really smart people there, they're all in a large corporate environment. And as I listen to you, it suddenly occurred to me that no matter how attractive a startup is, Texaco cannot let one of its quota out the door. They have to do whatever it takes to prevent that guy from joining one of my ventures and getting rich. And that's probably a good thing for the people who make up those quotas, because you let these people get rich and the bastards will start going Republican. No, affirmative action is protective. It protects them against ending up in a startup and getting a lot of problems with stuff. But I also want to comment on this, I call this the, if only Bill Gates had gotten his degree, who knows what he might have achieved, school of thought. There is no salvation outside the schoolhouse. If you don't get into Berkeley, you'll just never make it.
In Yale or jail, huh?
Yeah. I was an awful student. Isn't John J. Moore's on the one of the reasons? Yeah, he's my boss. He was a worse student, okay? And I worked for him. He's hoping to get rich by having me invest in the building he already has in church. But school doesn't matter all that much. Whether you went to Berkeley or to Davis or dropped out or, it's more caffeine and adrenaline that makes money these days. And we're really lying to students by telling them that it makes a great deal of difference whether you get into Berkeley versus Davis or not at all. It doesn't.
Okay. That's the hook. Thank you very much.
Thank you.